So, of course, patients want to know the bottom line in terms of what the benefit is, but a lot of them are also interested in why, and there's a lot of interesting science that sort of goes beyond that. So now let's start to get into, you know, really what happened when this trial came out. And before we get into the details of the trial, we want to bring up another case. But before we do that, there's another question for the audience. I was really struck when I heard about this case you're about to hear, because the patient continued to smoke after the diagnosis of lung cancer. So I'm just kind of curious when the last time was that you encountered a patient in your practice of any type who had lung cancer but was continuing to smoke, a very interesting dynamic. And while we're looking at the waiting for the results to come up, it looks like it's not uncommon. It looks like most of the audience has had a patient, quite a few. We've seen a patient like that in the last week. Really amazing. But we'll get into that with this case. So, Beth, there's a lot we could talk about this case, but maybe you can sort of briefly summarize what happened with this lady.
Yeah, so she's 71 years old, and you can see back in 2018, she had a resected 2.3 centimeter right lower lobe, and this was initially caught on a screening CT. She has a significant past medical history, though, of peripheral vascular disease, COPD, and hypertension. She recurred a little over a year later with hilar adenopathy that was found on routine surveillance imaging. She was bronched in December of last year. It kind of was 8 weeks because she had missed a week in the middle because her grandson was in a car accident, and she didn't tell any of us. She just kind of left and went to be with him, and it was concerning. So then she had moderate esophagitis, but she never lost any weight. Some shortness of breath that worsened with chemo radiation, which is probably due to her underlying COPD. Some nausea, vomiting, but generally she tolerated pretty well. And has gone on to receive durvalumab in the post-chemo radiation setting.
So these two patients that we presented, you know, I would say, I think are more typical patients who do well. We're going to present two other patients who had problems. Anything else you want to say about her course and also about her? You were mentioning a little bit about her concerns about travel, et cetera. But what about the smoking? I thought that was, it's amazing. Half of the audience has seen a patient in the last month with lung cancer who smokes. I mean, amazing. Can you talk a little bit about her as a person, Beth, and what was it like to take care of her?
Yeah, so she was a two-pack-a-day smoker, and she did not quit in 2018 when she was resected with curative intent. She did not quit at the time she had recurrent disease in 2019, but she did quit about 2 weeks into concurrent chemo radiation. And, you know, she acknowledged that it was very hard to quit. The nicotine addiction is very difficult to overcome. But she also said, I got sick of my daughter nagging me, so I just stopped. And I said, that's amazing, because it's really hard to stop cold turkey. She did not do a patch. She did not take varenicline. She just stopped because she was sick of her daughter nagging her, she said. And that was actually really interesting, to stop mid-treatment as opposed to kind of at that teachable moment when you were diagnosed.
Interesting. Stephen, any comments about the issue of people continuing to smoke? Any strategies that you've seen in terms of management for people who want to quit that seem effective?
We certainly offer pharmacologic support and, you know, sort of persistence without trying to nag too much in the clinic. We have a multidisciplinary approach, and we kind of sorted it out so where there's a good cop, bad cop. Our pulmonologist is clearly the bad cop. He's very harsh, comes in sort of spouting out bad outcomes, recurrence, and then I usually come in with a sort of good cop, supportive, there to help. Persistent. And, you know, some people really respond to the bad cop routine, and some really don't. So there's no perfect strategy. We acknowledge that it is difficult, but we also tell them that it is important.
I'd say it's a bad disease. It's a bad, bad disease, nicotine addiction, very, very severe addiction to try to recover from. In any event, we could talk a lot about that, but let's move on and talk about the trial that we've been talking about, the Pacific trial. And Ben, can you talk a little bit about sort of how the trial was designed?
Yeah, just briefly, you know, these were patients that, remember, not all stage threes are, most of them are unresectable. So this was unresectable stage three lung cancer who had not experienced progression after definitive concurrent chemo radiation. All patients were allowed, independent of their PD-L1 And patients post-concurrent chemoradiation, if they had at least stable disease, were randomized 2-to-1 to consolidation durvalumab every 2 weeks for 12 months versus placebo. Remember, at the time that this trial was designed, the standard of care was nothing. So placebo was a reasonable control arm. We didn't have any real strategies post-concurrent chemoradiation.
But it is kind of amazing when you think about, you know, from a more of a broad perspective, and this is not just about lung cancer, about oncology in general, asking a patient to receive placebo infusions for a year.
It is. And you have to, it's tough, but, you know, keep in mind that what Stephen went over, we've tried, it's not for lack of trying to understand consolidative efforts, either targeted therapies in an unselect group of patients or other types of vaccines that haven't worked. So placebo was the standard, and the trial did enroll pretty quickly. Primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and I believe overall survival. We saw a readout first with PFS, and then of course afterwards saw an OS readout.
And we'll take a look at those slides. One other thing, Stephen, I was curious about, and again, just as a principal in oncology, going back to the trial design here, the fact that, quote, there was a 2-to-1 randomization. In other words, the computer randomly assigned, but 2 out of 3 patients got the experimental treatment. What's the reason for doing that? I guess the idea is it's pretty tough to take a placebo, so you want to decrease the chance that that'll happen. Why do you do it this way, Stephen?
Yeah, certainly from an equipoise standpoint and making the trial more attractive to patients if you have a greater likelihood of enrolling in that arm. But it also actually has to do with statistical power. And when you think that that arm is clearly going to be better than the other arm, your sample size can be smaller by doing a this weighted randomization.
So maybe we can take a look at some of the results because they were pretty dramatic. And, you know, we're showing a lot of trials here, and we're going to show one at the end of this conference that are really major, major advances. And when you see curves that are separated like you see here, you know you have a major effect. Ben, can you walk through first what was seen in terms of progression-free survival? So here we're following these patients after getting chemoradiation durvalumab to see whether they develop metastatic disease, what was seen?
I mean, I think the pictures are pretty telling in terms of the curves, and we see this coveted space between two curves that we don't normally see or not accustomed to seeing in stage 3, at least. We saw a hazard ratio of 0.51, and we saw landmark analysis that were pretty telling. 55% of patients at 12 months were without progression in the durva arm versus 34 in the placebo arm. And then at 18 months, you're seeing a maintaining of the divergence of the curves. So pretty telling that these stayed separated, which then, you know, of course, translated into other outcomes that we'll see. But the curves diverge also very early on, which is important. We don't see a crossing of the curves that we see sometimes with immunotherapy trials in the advanced stage setting. These curves diverge early. They stayed separated, and you know, to see close to half of the patients still without progression at 18 months post concurrent chemoradiation in the durva arm is pretty compelling.
But Beth, you know, it also emphasizes the fact that this is a serious situation here. If you look at the control arm, which is the way patients have been, you know, what's been happening for 10, 15 years. By 18 months, 3/4 of these patients already had recurred, there's a big, you know, improvement. But you can call it localized disease, Beth. But I guess the reality is the vast majority of these people end up developing metastases at least before durvalumab.
It's absolutely consistent with my practice. Unfortunately, so many of these patients have recurrent metastatic disease. This stage 3 is an aggressive cancer, and it's serious. That's why we try to take any possible intervention that we can in this curative intent window.
So let's take a look at a couple more of the slides from the trial, because there are a bunch of details that are actually pretty important in terms of making these decisions. First, we see, and Stephen, maybe you can comment on this, the survival or time to death. Also, new lesions in terms of development of metastatic disease. Any comments on that, Stephen?
Yeah, on the left, the time to death or distant metastasis, this is not an outcome we quote very often. You certainly wouldn't explain it this way to your patients. This is put here before we had overall survival data. This is really representing a failure of the drug. And when we looked at sites of relapse, we saw that durvalumab did decrease brain metastases, suggesting that it did have more of a systemic effect, that really it was leading to more kill of that residual tumor and preventing distant relapse, not just locally. So there really was a systemic overall improvement.
What about survival? We started to see some data coming out on that now also, Stephen.
I mean, this was exciting. As Ben had mentioned, when we saw the magnitude of progression-free survival benefit, most of us changed practice. That was enough, just the magnitude there. And we assumed that would translate to an improvement in overall survival. And we learned in Toronto 2018, when these were first presented, that in fact it did. That we did see that translation to an improvement in survival. Hazard ratio of 0.68. Another way to think of that is a 32% reduction in the risk of death over the course of this trial, which is significant.
And of course, we're going to have to wait to see whether or not we actually change the long-term cure rate. But another issue that's come up, Ben, is whether every patient should be treated with this strategy. Overall, the trial showed this benefit, and that really is the main result that we look at. But when you look at different subsets, you see interesting issues. One that came out last Thursday is the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in people with targetable mutations. Are they as effective? Yeah. And there weren't that many patients. If you look down at the bottom there, you see patients in the Pacific trial who had an EGFR tumor mutation. What was your take on that, Ben?
I think this is the subset that we're still wrestling with. This was the group that didn't seem to benefit. The hazard ratio or the confidence interval crossing unity on both PFS on the left and really didn't see an overall survival advantage in this subset. And every other subset, we seem to see a benefit, but this is the one where maybe we don't have a benefit with consolidation DURVA. And there's a lot of questions with the ADAURA trial coming out, whether there were better drugs in this setting. So there's still controversy on the EGFR mutant subset from this trial and whether it's a small number of patients, I want to say. This was the group that may not have benefited as much as the other groups.
And we'll see, you know, we'll talk about the ADAURA trial that was used in the adjuvant setting. You have data in the metastatic setting where you see EGFR TKIs, but in the middle right now, we don't know exactly where this fits in with stage three. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the ADAURA trial. But Stephen, one other subset or one other consideration, and you hear about this all through oncology, of course, is PD-L1 level. And do patients who are PD-L1 negative actually benefit from durvalumab in this situation? What was your take on that one, Stephen?
So if you look at the top there, we have pre-specified cutoffs. And the study was designed to answer the question, using a cutoff of 25%, do we see a difference in terms of the benefit for durvalumab? And we did not. And so based on what the study was designed to show, PD-L1 did not influence it. Now, if you look at the bottom, this post hoc analysis, this was requested by the European Medicines Agency for European approval of the drug. And so they looked at less than 1%. You can see that the hazard ratio really seems to be on the wrong side. It's important to note this was not pre-planned. This study was not powered to answer that question, and a significant portion of samples were simply inevaluable. And while PD-L1 may predict outcome, these PD-L1 specimens are from biopsies taken before chemoradiation. We don't know what the PD-L1 status is after chemoradiation, and there's emerging evidence that that can change. Right now in the U.S., PD-L1 expression is not required for use of durvalumab, and it really doesn't come into play in my own practice.
We're going to talk about the toxicity from the trial also, but in terms of benefit, we don't know right now, Beth, whether, you know, what the long-term 5 or 10 year results are going to be. But I guess the hope here is, and it kind of reminds me a little bit of adjuvant therapy, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, that we're actually going to improve the cure rate. And I'm just kind of curious, is that something you talk about with your patients? You would think that would be a strong motivational factor.
Absolutely. That's what they're there for. And I remind them that this is curative intent therapy. Sometimes oncologists will say definitive treatment. I'm like, hey guys, it's okay to use the C word. It's curative intent therapy. That's our goal of treatment. It's all right to say that. And that's what patients really want to hear. But I think once we saw that overall survival data for durvalumab, it was really important to say to patients, listen, this is something that has improved survival. So it's very important to try to, you know, be compliant and take this medication.
So we're seeing other trials in this same situation, looking at checkpoint inhibitors using the other checkpoint. We know there's six of them out there, potentially, that could be utilized even more than that. But Ben, another strategy that's being looked at in clinical trials is really what's going on with metastatic disease, which is actually to combine chemotherapy with a checkpoint inhibitor. Again, that's standard therapy right now, metastatic disease. Now we're seeing trials trying to do that with chemo radiation, Ben. Yeah. What's involved there? You would wonder about toxicity in that situation.
Yeah, I think we've seen at least from the, some of the phase one data from this, that the toxicity signals just aren't there that we thought would be there. And this has kind of given a foundation for us to explore this and future trials. The specific two is one of those trials that is looking a little bit different strategy. Yes, they're giving consolidation durva on the back end, but they're also giving the durva in combination with chemotherapy with the radiation. So, you know, that's certainly one strategy that's being looked at. The other strategy that's, again, being adopted from the advanced A setting is dual checkpoint blockade, the combination of PD-1 or PD-L1 drug in combination with a CTLA-4 drug, a la Ipi-Nivo, and looking at that as consolidation rather than just single agent PD-L1 drug. So I think we're just trying to build on the science, and the safety signals that we thought were going to be there aren't there. Remember, we thought that consolidation durva, if you moved it closer to the radiation, there was going to be more toxicity from the Pacific trial. We didn't see that. So I think there's a lot of rationale to start looking at it in combination concurrently with radiation.
And we were talking about the Ipi-Nivo non-chemotherapy all-checkpoint inhibitor combination last Thursday in the metastatic situation, Stephen. And, you know, right now there's a lot of debate about this. The new data was just presented the last couple of weeks at ASCO. It is among the approved regimens. I know Ben, in his talk for this program, went through the idea of using Ipi-Nivo in the locally advanced situation. Any comment about that regimen in metastatic disease, Stephen? Or are you actually using it right now? It is approved first line.
It is approved. So there are two regimens now approved for the treatment of treatment naive and first line setting non-small cell lung cancer without a driver that utilize CTLA-4. One is nivolumab and ipilimumab. One is nivolumab, ipilimumab plus chemotherapy, CheckMate 9LA regimen, both of those FDA approved. I think we're still sort of working out where to best use these, certainly tailoring it to specific circumstances. I do use it in my practice. I do use nivolumab, ipilimumab. I think it will have a place. Right now, it's FDA approved for the treatment of PD-L1 positive lung cancer. In my own practice, between you and me, I am using it in the PD-L1 negative cohort. I think that its performance there was fairly impressive. I like the idea of maybe skipping chemotherapy in some patients if we can, particularly in the pandemic. And it does make subsequent lines of therapy maybe more appealing because then you can use chemotherapy later.
So we actually had Suresh Ramalingam, who was the investigator, presented the Ipi-Nivo trial on our conference webinar last Thursday, talking about this. Just kind of curious, Stephen, you know, you hear Ipi-Nivo, there's Ipi-Nivo. Of course, melanoma, it's used a lot. But depending upon what the dose and schedule is, it may or may not be as toxic as it is in melanoma. What's been your experience so far, Stephen, with lung cancer patients in Ipi-Nivo?
I've been pleasantly surprised. I think that, you know, as Beth and Liz have pointed out, we used a lot of Nivo-Ipi for small cell. And in those earlier days, we were still kind of figuring out the dose. Ipi is an interesting drug. We're not 100% sure exactly what's happening when we give a drug like ipilimumab. And so the dose seems to vary by disease type. It took us a while to come to this dose, but low-dose ipilimumab here at a dose of 1 mg/kg IV every 6 weeks, that seems to be much better tolerated. I've been pleasantly surprised by tolerability.